Hi, this is Mark Snow, composer for the X-Files, and you are listening to the fabulous X-Cast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, as ever, and this week we're covering the 15th episode of the second season of The X-Files, Fresh Bones. And I'm delighted to be joined for the very first time on the X-Cast by celebrated writer Jim Beard. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Boy, that makes me sound really cool.
I would say you are really cool. Well, I'm celebrating you here and now.
Lovely.
Jim's a writer who's contributed to, among many other things, the most recent X-Files IDW publishing anthology, Secret Agendas. And we're going to talk about his short story, Desperately Seeking Mothman, at the very end of the show. So Jim can talk through. We've done a blog interview with Jim, which you may or may not have seen. Of course you've all seen it. Of course you all read the blog. They better.
Right.
We'll have a little bit of chat about it at the end of the episode and about Jim in general. But before then, I'm going to start the episode by asking Jim the classic five questions of X, which I ask every new guest, which you'll all be familiar with. So Jim, to kick us off, when did you first discover the X-Files?
I have to credit my lovely wife for that. Being much smarter than me, she started right in on first season.
Yeah,
when the show premiered, and you know, it's been such a long time now that I can't remember exactly why it was that I did not sit down with her to watch first season, but I didn't. That's really odd because we usually would sit down and watch any sort of supernatural, science fiction, fantasy program together, but so I don't remember what it was. I don't know if it didn't intrigue me enough, or it didn't sound interesting, or something else was going on. I can't imagine. But she said, "You know what? I'm going to watch this," and I said, "Okay, you just let me know what it's like." And she did, and I remember as first season was going along, she was talking about it a lot, and that seemed to signal something to me that okay, maybe there's something going on here that's good. So first season ended and she said, you really ought to sit down and watch the show with me. So I came in at second season. So no angry emails, X-Fans, please. Somehow I did go back through repeats or whatever, and I'm pretty sure I've seen all of season one. So I'm a season two baby, not a season one baby.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Jim, because I'm exactly the same.
I don't feel so bad now.
Yeah, exactly. We're in this together. I started watching it from the episode One Breath, which we did a few weeks ago. And then I then went back and watched the earlier episodes. And it took me a few years to actually go back and watch some of the early season one episodes. I always remember Fallen Angel in season one being one that I didn't see for years on end, probably until well into watching the actual show as it aired. And so it always stuck out to me as a strange one. So yeah, it's more common than you think, I think, Jim. Don't worry.
Okay, good. I don't feel so bad now.
Oh, there you go.
they're not going to take my X-Files credentials away, because of that.
We were in danger of that for a minute, but we've pulled it back. It's all good.
I felt that. I felt that press of danger upon me.
So if you started in season two then, what would your favorite episode be? Is it a season two episode? Or
I thought about this a lot. And these questions were fed to me previously.
Yeah.
Full disclosure here, folks.
You've had time to think, yeah.
I did, and I hate this question.
It's difficult.
I don't want to fall back on the old cliche of, I love them all, or something like that. But it was really hard to really come down on just a few that I liked, and my knee-jerk reaction was going to be Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
I don't blame you.
And I thought, no, I can't say that one. No one will take me seriously. So I do love that. I remember that my wife and I had such a good time watching that. It's because it sort of came out of nowhere, and we didn't know whether or not we were supposed to be considering it canon. Mm.
Yeah.
But one of the other ones that really sticks out in my mind is Clyde Bruckman's. And what I love about it is the moment when our heroes find out the way they're both going to die. And to this day, my wife and I still refer back to that. We still bring that up. And of course, Mulder's is fairly comedic, darkly comedic, but comedic when it comes up, but probably close to his character. But we still mention the answer to Scully. How do I die? And it's, you don't.
You don't. Yeah.
Yeah. And we've talked about that. Like, did that really come true? Will it still come true? So that sticks out in my mind. And I think beyond that, I'm going to bring up the two Eugene Toombs episodes.
Mm.
That, again, ones that really made us perk up and that we talked about. And I think that's a true test of what's a good episode is how much does it stick with you? How much do you bring it up later as you go along through life and remember it and talk about it?
Yeah, and it's funny because you mentioned in the Scully thing, that's actually started playing into the show a little bit now. There was, in Mulder and Scully Meet the Weir Monster, in the most recent season, there is a more than oblique reference to the whole, you know, Scully even jokingly says, well, I am immortal, or something to those effects.
Exactly, yes. I think we cheered a little bit.
Yeah, at that so point. It's...
Oh my God, you know what that is, yes.
And exactly, and from a mythology standpoint, as far as I'm aware, part of the reason that might well be true is because Scully actually has a chip in her, has some kind of technology in her that cured her cancer, which may also be some sort of, you know, cure for all disease, etc., things like that. So there's a few little clues without it ever being too on the nose. But it's those kind of questions, isn't it, that episodes like Clyde Bruckman throw up, which, yeah, stay with you. Favourite season, then? What would you say that would be off the back of Clyde Bruckman? You mentioned two season three episodes there, so I'm guessing maybe that season.
It probably is, and this was another tough question, and I look back over overviews of the seasons, and it really struck me that, and I don't know if anybody will agree with me, season three seems to be when the show came into its own, when it hit its stride, perhaps. Not that it was floundering before then, but I think it felt more comfortable in its own skin. Mm-hmm. Which really conjures up some really great visual images. But in season three, I felt perhaps the writing got better. They were taking some chances, even within the show itself, obviously was a big chance to be taken by producers and directors and all of that. But yeah, I'm going to say potentially season three for those reasons, if that makes any sense at all.
Oh yeah, completely. And I think that's... that's very true, in that season two, you know, as an episode of which we're going to talk about today, has some really great episodes, and it really is a step up from season one. But season three, yeah, it really starts to click. Everything, without it becoming formulaic, it's really pushing the envelope in a lot of different ways. So it's the amount of people who say season three or mention a season three episode as their favorite episode is huge whenever people come on this show. So yeah, it is on the whole the consensus. Either that or season four, which a lot of people love as well.
Put it this way, could Jose Chung's From Outer Space have happened in season one or season two? I say no. I think that they may have lost people at that point. I think everybody was more comfortable with what they were doing by the time that aired. And I don't see that happening early on.
Yeah, they tested the water with Humbug in season two, the first comedy episode, and everyone reacted really well with that, and they thought that this is really good. But then, yeah, season three, they really went with that. So I agree, yeah. If you've got a favourite episode, favourite season, what about favourite character? Who would you say yours is? And this can be anybody. It doesn't have to be a regular cast member. It could be guest cast.
Now, you put everybody through this, right? It's not just me that you're... floating on these.
I promise, Jim, everybody gets this test.
Okay. Boy, if I haven't gotten the death threats yet, I have to pick a favorite character. Oh, my goodness.
I tell you what, you think this is bad. You talk to anyone who's been on this show about the X quiz, which I am sparing you of. That is notorious for being really, really difficult. I have people dreading it.
I'm probably going to have to... And we're talking about any character on the show, or right?
Anyone.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm really fond of Skinner as a character, and I liked when we watched his growth as a character a lot. But honestly, I'm going to go with Scully. I'm not exactly a skeptic myself, but I'm not a believer. I'm fairly agnostic as far as that goes. But I think it's a combination of the character as written, the character growth, the actress involved that makes me lean towards her. Plus, she's a fellow redhead.
Yeah.
So I have to go there.
That's a good reason. Yeah.
And I think that I feel far more sympathy for Scully as the show went on to where we're at right now. That means a lot to me right there, to really feel true emotion for a fictional character.
She's often a the character a lot of people say, more than Mulder, actually, funnily enough.
Yeah.
More people tend to say Scully because... I think the majority of people tend to think that Scully actually is probably the more rounded character of the two. If they're both really great, but I think there's just something else about Scully and the way she obviously went on to inspire so many women, you know, as one of those role models. She's fantastic, and I think that choice makes absolute sense. Yeah, absolutely. Lastly, then, on the five, it's nearly over, Jim. Don't worry. The last one is... what would you say, thinking of all this stuff we've talked about, what would you say if you had to pick a favorite moment from the show, one scene or anything that sticks out at you, what would it be?
I don't know if it's a cheat or not. I'm going to go back to Clyde Bruckman.
That's okay.
I'm going to go back to the answers that they got, and especially Scully's answer. I don't see that anybody could have seen that coming. And with just a few words... It's like an anvil drops on your head. You think one thing, and then you think, no, there's another thing. We've already, you know, we've talked about this. There's different interpretations. In a romantic sense, it could mean that her memory continues.
Mm.
As we say of our own loved ones, they're not truly dead if we always remember them. Writers never die because they're there through their writing.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a bias there, but a filmmaker is not gone when we watch their films. So that's what I think I really love about that moment is that it was unexpected. And I really love what Jillian does. She's kind of very smug when she says, like, and how do I die? Kind, you know, that like sort of thing. And she and the audience and we don't really get the answer that we might have expected. And I love it because it's so open-ended.
Yeah.
What does it mean? When will we find out? Will we ever find out? And it's just, it's a very, very, very lovely moment that, and I've said it before, it really has stuck with me all this time.
Yeah. I completely understand why. And I think, It's a mission of mine to get as many people involved in the X-Files on this show as possible. I want to get Darren Morgan one day. And if we get Darren Morgan, one of the things I'm going to ask him is this. This is one of the first questions I'm going to ask him. Why did you write that line? Why did you have Clyde Bruckman say that to her? Because that is a wonderful thing that is very, very rarely ever really addressed. It's not even addressed till like the latest season. And it's still done with a tongue-in-cheek. So it's just, like you said, it's that anvil dropping on your head. It is that moment of, what does that mean? And that's the beauty of it. So,
as a writer, that intrigues me because I would love to know whether or not that was in conjunction with Chris Carter and the rest of the team. I've worked completely solo. I've worked as part of a team. And I really want to know. How did, was that his idea? Did Chris say to him, let's plant a seed here? I know where this is going, so I want to express that? Or did he say, yeah, that's great, keep that, we can use it? I'd love to know where that germ of an idea came from, and if they played to it, or there already was some sort of plan in place. Really, to me, really, as a writer, fascinating, fascinating stuff.
Great answer. Great response, Jim. We haven't had that one before either, so brilliant. So, yeah, that's your five questions of X. You survived. Well done. So, yeah, that gives you gives us a good gauge of your fandom there, Jim. And beyond that, let's move on and let's talk about what we're here to talk about today. So that's the episode in question, Fresh Bones. Fresh Bones is the 15th episode of the second season of The X-Files. It first aired on February the 3rd, 1995. It was written by Howard Gordon and directed by Rob Bowman. After several murders occur within a refugee camp for Haitians, Mulder and Scully are caught in the middle of a secret battle involving the camp commander and a possible voodoo priest.
Well, they were pretty dumb, I guess. But the way he told them always made me laugh. Then he got transferred to the camp. And nothing was very funny anymore.
Did he ever discuss with you what went on there? What his duties included?
No. He'd just come home angry. Mostly at himself, though sometimes he'd turn it on Luke and me.
Was he ever treated for depression or stress?
No, I tried getting him to talk to someone. Even our minister. But Dad believed in dealing with his own problems.
Did he believe in voodoo?
The Marines, his family, and football pretty much sums up everything Jack believed in.
So when did you first think that his death involved something out of the ordinary?
One of the boys in his squad told me what they found at the accident. And he said it was some kind of voodoo curse. The same one they found on the stool that Puerto Rican boy used to hang himself.
Who told you that?
Harry Dunham. He's from New Orleans, so he's pretty superstitious about that type of thing.
And what about you?
My husband had just died, so I didn't give it much thought either way. Not until Luke dug this up out of his sandbox. I know it sounds crazy, me worrying about all this. The truth is, I'm scared. I'm scared for my child. And I just don't know what to do anymore.
So, out of 10, Jim, what would you give Fresh Bones as an episode?
I'm going to give it a 6. It's not a bad episode, but it's definitely not a standout episode. I do a podcast about the 1966 Batman TV series.
Oh, awesome.
And as we worked our way through it and we got down to some of the, let's say, lesser episodes, third season, what we found was that even in a bad episode or a not so great episode, there were certain things that there was at least bits in there that we could say that were good or interesting or elevated the episode. And that's how I feel about Fresh Bones. It's fairly cliche ridden. It's fairly stereotypical in many ways in its setup and in its theme and in its characters. But there are moments in it that are really nice. And a lot of that to me is the supernatural or special effects. Like I love the moment where Scully starts freaking out and the guy crawls out of her skin, basically. It's really great moment and really well done. And the last scene just blows me away. It's a particular phobia of mine. And I think if I'm not mistaken, that's called taphobia.
Okay.
It's like such a serious phobia of mine. I actually had to look it up one time ago, and that's the fear of being buried alive.
Wow.
Really, really incredible last scene there. So that elevated it. I was thinking about saying 5. You were right in the middle, but I'm going to give it a 6 for those couple of scenes. Other than that, the wicked military commander gone bad. The sort of stereotypical view of something like voodoo, the ethnic connections to it. Now, interestingly enough, we're talking about an episode dealing with foreigners coming into a country. So, and I'm not going to get, you know, too political now, but it's interesting how that's so topical now. Again, I really feel like they handled it in a fairly cliche ridden way. Not so horribly bad. Not necessarily are the Haitians represented as overly bad stereotypes, but, and I think it's literally just that it's the hour long format. There just isn't time to go into it more, show them as a little bit more rounded. I felt like the child character was fairly stereotypical. He's the wise ass kid who's playing, you know, who's the capitalist, gotta sell you something, and then you go to him to get the information. I do really like the twist at the end that they learn that the kid's been dead, because that's really the one thing that you couldn't necessarily explain away. If you're going to take Scully's tack on this whole thing, most of what happened, or all of what happened, can be explained by the use of narcotics. That one's a little harder to explain.
Yeah.
Unless they're being lied to about the child.
Yeah, there is some real moments in this that make me really have to stop and pause and I think I would give Fresh Bones, probably I would give it a 7.5, and that's higher than I thought I would, actually. But the reason I remember I gave it that is because I always remember, I've always said to people, I think season 2 is where the X-Files is at its scariest. I think there's just something about season 2 where they get that mixture right of really well-told stories, but also they don't quite lose that sort of gritty, cold Vancouver style of chills. That later on in the show, it's still really good, but they kind of lose that a little bit. It becomes a bit more slick and a bit more, you know, a bit more attractive on the eye. And I think Fresh Bones, and I don't mean that as a criticism, but it changes the kind of tone of the kind of stories they do. This episode is the one I always remember as scaring the living daylights out of me as a child. It was always Fresh Bones, and it's for quite a lot of the moments that you've mentioned earlier. The moment where Scully, gets attacked and in the car, and with the Haitian priest, you know, the burying alive, the maggots in the bowl, and all of these really sort of visceral things that are in this episode, even though it's actually got a lot of flaws to it, and the story itself is a little bit cliched, and it goes around the houses a little bit. I think for the fact that it actually picks out these truly chilling, terrifying moments, and it's probably because it marked me as a child that I remember it so vividly. But going back and watching it recently, it brought all that back, and I thought this is the X-Files, perhaps for me, at its most terrifying. So I think it bumps the episode up slightly in my mind for that respect, really.
I can see what you're saying, and I'm putting myself in the place of a child. Now, I wasn't a child when I watched it, and I'll admit it, my wife and I do tend to challenge movies and TV shows to scare us. I don't think I've been truly frightened or gotten a feeling of fright from something like this in a long while. And we do that all the time. You know, we're hoping that something will. But I'm thinking back, and I wasn't at the time. I'm going to bring up Eugene Toombs again. Now, that was creepy. It could very well be that maybe I've just never really been impressed by voodoo stories. That's maybe where my bias is coming in there. What I also find interesting, talking about topical things, is the zombie craze that we're in currently and have been for quite a while now. Zombies are a really interesting thing in fiction because we're in the middle of a what I would call a scientific zombie craze. Something changed at some point, zombies going farther back being from voodoo, and somebody can challenge me on this. It might be Night of the Living Dead popularized the idea of what, again, what I would call a scientific zombie, a zombie not produced by supernatural means or magical means, but by a virus, something from outer space, something along those lines. It's interesting that we didn't get any sort of true zombies in this episode, but and it's funny because if they did, I probably would have said, "Wow, what a cliche!"
Yeah,
I really felt like we didn't really get enough out of the priest. That maybe I would. His name is Beauvais.
Beauvais, yeah.
To get a little bit more of where he was coming from, I would have liked to have gotten, again, more about Beauvais and maybe his background, or again, more of what he was thinking. I think Wharton gets what he deserves for the most part.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Another thing that elevates this a little bit is the appearance of X.
Yes, definitely.
And I didn't remember that in the slightest.
And me
when
neither.
He appeared, I was totally surprised.
Yeah.
Because for some reason, I was thinking that he only appeared in mythology episodes.
Well, I knew he appeared in a couple of different ones. Like, I remember him in Softlight, because he plays quite an important role in Softlight towards the end of the season. But, and yeah, I completely forgot that he was in this. Only when I saw Stephen Williams pop up as the on the guest list, I was like, oh wow, what, X? And it took me a moment to go, oh yeah, he's only in it briefly. But I like that, because Deep Throat used to do the same. Deep Throat occasionally cropped up in episodes that weren't directly mythology in season one, so it's nice that. And they do the same in the end with Marita Covarrubias later down the road. She appears in one or two episodes that aren't directly based on the alien mythology. So I like the way that the X-Files, when it has the informants in the show more in the first like run of seasons, that it occasionally drops people like X in when you don't expect them to be there, which was the case for here.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you feel that it was necessary for it to be X? Is he shoehorned into this, in your opinion, or does it seem natural that it would be that character that would go to Mulder and give him the heads up?
There's two different ways to look at this. On the one hand, X being involved could well be a way for them to kind of, you know, track back to the last time we saw him. You know, Mulder even says to him,
"Yeah,
I didn't expect to see you again." And that was after One Breath, where he basically, you know, they have this massive confrontation. X kills a man in front of him and then, you know, gives him the tools to get a revenge on Scully. And I think he thought that was it. You know, they'd reached a point of no return. So I think they did it just to remind everyone that he's here and he's around and he's in the ether. So
okay,
I don't necessarily agree it had to be him, no. IMDb, just finally, out of 2,046 votes, Fresh Bones gets 7.2 out of 10 on IMDb, which compared to a lot of other episodes, it's one of the lowest rated episodes in season two, actually. It's only beaten in the low rating stakes by the episode with the vampires. And Excelsis Day is on a par with it. And we talked about Excelsis Day earlier in the season and roundly trounced it as being a rubbish episode of the show, probably the worst episode of the season. So I think it's better than that, guys. IMDb, guys. Give it a bit more credit. Come on, it's better than that. So on that, let's talk a bit more in detail about Fresh Bones. So the teaser opens up with a really sort of unnerving teaser with the character of Jack McAlpine, who's the Army Marine who is experiencing visions and he's scaring his family to death, you know, his wife and his young child. And he, you know, as I mentioned earlier, he sees the maggots in the cereal and, you know, when he's eating it, and he's wound up, isn't he? He's wound up, he's tense. And there was a horrible point here where the mother actually starts crying when he shouts at her, and the baby starts crying as well. And that really unsettled me when I watched it. I was like, oh my God, that's horrible.
One of the things that fascinates me about that is how they get child actors that young to react the way that they want them to, because they may not completely understand what they're doing, that they're being filmed in a TV production. So it's very interesting. That's a fairly young child there, and I'm going to guess that the actress playing the wife is not his real mother.
Mm.
So she starts to cry, and then the kid starts to cry. It's very, very realistic.
Yeah, it is.
And I'll give them that. So, but you have to wonder, well, how did they get him to cry like that?
Mm.
What they had to do was make him uncomfortable to the point that he cries. So what they're doing is that child is not acting in the sense that we know acting. He's really feeling whatever it is that they want him to feel, so they get that reaction out of him. It's kind of cruel in a way.
I hadn't thought of it like that. That's true, actually.
Now,
it's a bit worrying.
Now, we have people in modern filming, we have people, and they're usually on set to make sure that children are not being tortured or something along that lines, and they're being treated fairly and all of that. But it really makes me wonder if the true parent was off screen and getting that reaction out of the child, or if the child is simply reacting to the actress playing the wife, because it seems like that's what he's doing. And it's a really wonderful reaction, and it's so realistic of a reaction, because children do, like animals, go base what they're feeling off of the people around them, and especially the people that they're connected with. He sees his mother in distress, so the distress rises in him.
And it's just really well done. It's really evocative. So you're left with... The whole teaser just left me with a real sense of unease. You know, obviously it ends up with Jack seemingly being killed in this car crash with the occult symbol, the occult voodoo symbol on the tree. But it sets the tone for the whole thing. It's scary. It's creepy. It's edgy. It puts you on edge. Rob Bowman, interestingly enough, he's one of those directors. He's one of the two directors, I think, in The X-Files, as well as Kim Manners. Actually, no, tell a lie, three. One of three directors, Kim Manners, Rob Bowman, and David Nutter, who, for me, are the directors that really stand out when their episodes appear. And Rob Bowman just has this... He has this knack of being able to capture the tone and feel of a script, whether it's the kind of eeriness of something like Gender Bender or the... You know, a lot of the mythology episodes and the paranoia of the kind of ones he does, like Little Green Men. I think he does One Breath. But yeah, he really manages to capture whatever he's doing. And I think he gets that right from the off, Rob Bowman, and he just creeps you out throughout this entire episode.
There's a definite atmosphere that's consistent and prevailing in this. And I will absolutely admit that, yes.
Yeah. And I think this is one of Howard Gordon's better scripts, but I think to an extent, Howard Gordon is funny because he is hit and miss with his scripts, and he's quite often, it's interesting how he went on to write, be an executive producer on 24, because quite often a lot of his scripts end up being about either the military or very sort of powerful and slightly egomaniacal men who are doing wrong things. That's quite a recurring theme in a lot of Howard Gordon's work. He did Sleepless earlier this season, which is all about, the Vietnam veterans being abused and things like that with sleep deprivation. And this, if this episode is like any other episode, I think it's like The List in season 3, which is the one with J.T. Walsh as the evil prison warden and the reincarnated murderer. And it reminds me a lot of that. Obviously, that came later, and that was Chris Carter. But Fresh Bones is one of those stories that I think from the very beginning, it's a recurring theme in The X-Files, I think, what this episode is. And I love, after you get out of the teaser, I love the fact that straight away, when Mulder and Scully are doing the briefing in the car to set the episode up and introducing the whole case, they mention Chester Bonaparte, the boy, don't they? Right from the very beginning, there's the reference to the fact that a boy has been, 10-year-old boy has been killed in a refugee camp.
Okay, so we assume that that's who they're referring to, although they're not aware of who the boy was.
Well, that's my assumption, that Howard Gordon is setting that up very early on to put the seed in our mind that a boy died in this riot that took place that Bouvet, triggered.
Okay. And, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I skipped right over that. Boy, good one.
Well, yeah, it just clicked with me. And then I went, oh, okay. Because I always remember Chester. Chester really stands, again, he's one of the things in this episode that I always remember, the idea of that they were talking to a ghost all the way through. Or whatever Chester was, because there is a bit of ambiguity, really, as to what's going on with Chester. But I like the way the episode kind of prefigures that, almost, for me, anyway.
Or is he a zombie?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe, yeah. In fact, that might make more sense, actually.
If we're looking at it from Scully's point of view, the boy was only presumed dead, and but he seems to act on his own. So I guess it would be that he's just presumed dead. It's a little harder to figure that they're dealing with a ghost the whole time.
Yeah, I know. It does leave you going, okay.
But I like it. Remember, I don't care much for the character because I think he's a stereotype.
Yeah.
Of the wise ass kid and he's selling stuff and you got to give him, you got to feed him to get, you know, information out of him, that sort of thing. But I do really love the moment when they find out that this kid is supposedly dead.
It's a great little jaw drop moment, yeah. like the teacher at the end of Die Hand, Die Valets, which was last week's episode, where they see the message on the board, which always gives me chills. It's been nice working with you, and they're just left going, what the hell? I love episodes like that, like the X-Files, that end in that way, where they're just a little bit, you know, taken aback, and they have to just stop and think. And you never see their following conversation. You never see them go, was he a zombie? Was he a ghost? It's always just left with them going, oh.
Right.
So obviously, you know, they go and see Mrs. McAlpine, and she, you know, starts to connect some of the dots up about the voodoo curse that supposedly on, you know, she was worried was on Jack. It's interesting, they use voodoo a lot quite openly. Scully even leaps at the idea that voodoo might be involved when Mulder mentions that these are Haitian refugees. It's quite interesting how voodoo is immediately thrown out there as almost something like we should know about in advance, and we should be aware of the world of voodoo. And that struck me as surprising that Scully would just immediately go, well, maybe voodoo's involved.
Now, see, true, but that literally could be, we have X amount of time in this episode and we have to get to it.
Yeah.
So let's just, but that she's bringing it up, yes, interesting.
And it's the whole trope with Mrs. McAlpine, that she's the scared civilian calling our duo in to help them, which is something that often comes up in the X-Files, you know, a wife of somebody who's, you know, been killed, and it's been, you know, maybe something that's unjust or unjust, or she suspects there's other things going on. In this case, it's the refugee camp, which is, as you mentioned earlier, Jim, a really timely and fascinating thing. And I was watching this, and like you said, without getting too political, it just brings up so many things right now in the world that, you know, we're recording this a week after.
For both of our countries.
Well, exactly. For both of our countries. And we're recording this a week after the election of President Trump, and how things may change in terms of, you know, we're reading from the Brexit thing in the UK, and how this affects immigration and how people treat refugees, you know, the Syria problem and all these things. So to have an episode like this that puts the Haitians in the position of being very much the black men under the heel of a very traditional white man is, I think, quite telling, isn't it, really? It's quite a powerful story.
Yeah, it's one of these times where We're how many years out from this now?
20 years, yeah.
Wow. And in the connection is still there. In fact, it's probably even more, holds more weight now, potentially, than it did then.
Yeah, it does. And it's, Colonel Wharton is one of those characters who is almost, he's almost stereotypical. Even he's a strange character. Ultimately, what we find out about Wharton later on in the episode, but he is very much representative of that bullish kind of, you know, military man who considers these people to be an annoyance, to consider these people to be either dangerous or getting in the way of their progress or their, you know, what they could be doing. And he treats them accordingly, as not as people, but as people to be abused effectively. And it's a really interesting parallel to, if the world goes down a very dark rabbit hole, could end up happening. And there's the whole suggestions that this place is more like, I think he says at one point, you know, this isn't a concentration camp, but it feels like one.
Right. The one note about him that sort of elevates him as a character for me is that he absorbs and takes on an aspect of the people that he supposedly hates and twists and perverts it to his own use, of course. But it's the kind of thing you want to ask him, like, you know, you hate these people. Why, you know, how did you get to the point where you actually became a practitioner
of it? It is pretty fascinating, and it's not something I think Howard Gordon does enough with in the end, or he doesn't have time to do enough with to really sell the idea that when we get to the end and Wharton is, you know, he's practicing voodoo, that we've basically had one photo that's seen him with Bouvet late earlier, you know, in time, and that's about it really. And you think, well, it's an interesting way of doing it, but how did he get from A to B? How did he get to be, you know, hating these people, but also, yeah, practicing what they do? And it's an open question, really. It's interesting, though, in terms of the Haitian refugees, that Howard Gordon, he was inspired to write the episode after he read a couple of articles about suicides of servicemen in Haiti.
I saw that, yeah.
They came up with the refugee plot because they couldn't actually film in Haiti. So I think there was, they maybe thought about trying to set this in Haiti at first. And I think Daniel Benzali's good casting, isn't he? You know, obviously he's a bit of a celebrity spot, Daniel Benzali, well known for Murder One in the 90s. And I think he's good, isn't he? With a character that is a bit all over the place.
I think when I first saw him on screen, my immediate reaction was, oh, we've seen, he's played characters like that before.
Yeah.
But I think when you see him, there's almost no way to not think that this guy's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
You know, or that he might be behind everything. It's just one of those immediate things, and I think a lot of that is the actor himself. No, he's good in it because he's believable. You hate him.
Yeah.
That's what matters there, whether or not he's going to turn out to be, you know, the instigator behind everything. So, yeah, in that sense, good casting, sure.
I agree with you as well that really it's Bouvet who is the character who gets the least to do, you know. And obviously, you know, as Mulder and Scully get into talking to Wharton and trying to figure out more about how these men are dying, then, you know, Jack wasn't the first person seemingly to die, in air quotes. And there's more of these military men who've been dying connected to the Haitians. And eventually it gets Mulder to Bouvet. And he's talked about as like a revolutionary seeking freedom. He's the guy who started the prison riot, obviously, which sort of triggered a lot of this. He comes across as a bit cheesy and quasi-mystical in places when I think he could have been a much more interesting character.
I agree. Yeah, I absolutely would. I would have appreciated at least one scene with him talking more and learning a little bit more about him. But again, we only have so much time in these episodes. Now, I've seen that there was some criticism that some people felt that the beginning of the episode dragged, and then it jumped into, boy, you'd have to almost wonder what could have been excised early on, and perhaps that time could have been used to better effect. I don't know.
Maybe you could have cut out certain of things, like you maybe didn't need the scene with Mrs. McAlpine, you know, and maybe because it starts off being more about Jack McAlpine, but he very quickly sort of gets forgotten, really, and it becomes much more about, you know, Wharton and the voodoo. And what I love, and I think what I really love about this episode the most, is what happens to Scully, because all the way through, there is this really nice idea that Scully needs to believe almost in voodoo in order to save herself from it. You know, when Mulder pays Chester off and gets that totem that he keeps in his car, there's a really interesting conversation about how he wants to put his faith in this good luck charm that Chester seems to have given them, possibly to protect them from what he knows is there, this evil. But Scully thinks it's just all about the power of suggestion. She doesn't believe in that totem. But then later on, when she gets pricked by the thorn in the car, when it's left in there, and her face starts to turn ashen, and she has this really sort of personal quiet terror throughout the last half of the episode that something's happening to her, and she doesn't really voice it to Mulder, but she knows something's going wrong.
Two things that I was struck by. Scully says more than once in this episode that voodoo is based on fear. And I found that interesting because I would have loved to have heard from someone, and who knows, someone may be listening to this and will bring it up, how much that's true. I'm sure that practitioners of voodoo might not actually agree with that assessment of it, but it was interesting. She says it at least twice, if not three times, that it all hinges on fear. If they can create fear of what they're doing, that aids in putting the supernatural across to people. There's more in this episode to me of Scully's rationalization of voodoo and perhaps the chemicals involved than Mulder supporting the idea that it's supernatural. He seems to more or less go along with her assessment, talking about the chemicals that are used in zombification.
Yeah.
in this episode, but I did feel that was a good point that they were stressing about it all hinges upon fear to get across what the priest seems to be doing.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating idea, really, that it fuels the... And everyone is very afraid in this episode. You know, you've got Mrs. McAlpine, who's very afraid. You know, she's seeing these symbols. You've got Harry Dunham, who's the other military guy who was Jack's friend, and he's the one, he ends up being another victim. And he's terrified. He's terrified of he's afraid of Chester, for a start, because he says to them, don't trust that boy. He's more than he seems. He's afraid of Bouvet because he thinks that he's the one who's been killing these military men. And, you know, there is fear all the way through the episode. And it's almost like, what I love about the Scully arc is that it's only the point where she believes that totem might save her. When the man is choking her to death and blood's coming out of her mouth and she's just screaming in terror in that car, she grabs that totem and then it goes away.
Right.
And I think that's brilliant because it's a really subtle way of saying, Scully, if you believe, that may be salvation in this case. And that may get rid of the fear. That may take the fear away.
If it's not supernatural, how does grabbing that totem make that illusion go away?
Exactly.
It has to be, there's a, it must be a topical chemical on the charm that the moment that you touch it, it's a quick reaction, but it causes, you know, it dispels the illusion. I don't know. Hey, I want to talk about the dog really quick here. The dog corpse carcass is really effective, and it's really, really scary and creepy looking. Very creepy looking.
It really is, yeah.
There's a funny little thing when for one thing, we're robbed of an autopsy, a Scully autopsy scene.
With a dog.
Yeah, you know, we're looking forward to it, you know?
That would have been good.
You love the Scully autopsy scene. She puts the glasses on and she starts in on all of her, you know, her anatomical explanations. But when she says to Mulder, like, the body's not here, it's been replaced by... And she says something to the effect of a seemingly a dog carcass or something like that. And to me, I want to stop everything and go, well, what do you mean by that? Are you not sure that it's a dog? That was the first thing. It's like, is there a story here?
Yeah.
Maybe we can get a whole other episode out of this. I wanted to know what exactly she meant. Like, it's either a dog or it's not. And if it's not a dog, then it's a chupacabra. Do we need to open up an entirely new X-File on this thing? Because it doesn't overly look like a desiccated dog. It looks like some kind of alien. But it's really creepy. I'll give you that. It's a very scary, creepy looking thing. And I love the reaction from the guy when he pulls the tray out and that thing is there.
I think you would, wouldn't you? You'd be like, wow, this, I was not expecting this.
Heck yeah.
It was a little bit like right back in the pilot episode where they open the coffin of one of the students who've been abducted by aliens and it looks like a deformed alien thing and they all go, oh my God. It's that kind of reaction of the, and it happens a few times on the X-Files where you just completely are thrown by what's under the, you know, the autopsy thing. in the cold storage. But yeah, it is. It's one of those visceral moments. There's loads of them in this episode. There's loads of quite creepy, unnerving, quite horrible, you know, horror moments. And I think, you know, that's the point, obviously, that, that we find out eventually that Jack's alive. And I think it goes back to the whole, what you said about what the toxin that could be on the totem. It's the old whole idea of pufferfish tetrodotoxin, which is what the, which is the scientific explanation for the zombification, which is a real life thing. You know, they didn't make that up for the show. That is part of the zombification lore and the theory, the scientific theory about what, how this happens in Haiti. So there is that real balance in this episode, the classic X-Files balance of a scientific explanation for something, but also the true supernatural elements of this episode, because it has a lot of supernatural elements. Chester is the biggest one. Now, I said earlier that maybe he's a ghost, but then the thing is, what I'm confused about Chester, and I've been thinking about this as I was watching it, if he's a ghost, there's a few things that don't add up. Why does he have to run away from Mulder? When Mulder's trying to find him, and after he speaks to Dunham, why does Chester run and they have that long protracted chase? Why doesn't he just disappear there and then? But if he is just a zombie, when Mulder runs to the end of that pier and Chester's vanished, where did he go? How did he do that? Is he the black cat that Mulder then sees by the water?
Yes, exactly. And that, and that's, I think that's obviously what they want you to think. They want you, and I did, I'll admit it, I did think of that right there. It depends on what sort of rules of ghosts this show is setting up and putting across. I'd like to think of it more as he's a boy who everybody believes is dead, but somehow escaped whatever it was that supposedly killed him. And whether that's Beauvais' influence or direct action, it's really hard to say. It's hard to believe that they could interact with him so much and that he's a ghost. Where did all the food go that Mulder ordered?
Yeah, exactly.
For him, that's stretching it. And I guess you can make up any sort of rules about ghosts or spirits that you want in fiction, and I've done that in my own work. But that's, this is one that, that pretty much stretches it. To me, I'd like to believe that he escaped death somehow and feels like he can do better by operating the way he is. Although what's strange about it is that these people think that he's dead, but he's yet he's out and around them. He's in the camp. He's in the cemetery gathering frogs. So, yeah, that's a tough one. And I'm not necessarily saying it's bad. It's very thought-provoking, and you do sort of want to know more about it once the episode ends, of exactly what he was doing or what he was.
Yeah, and I love that. I love that about it. It's not, for me, it's not a question that leaves me furious. It's more a question of, well, what was Chester? You know, what was...
Yeah.
His function seems to have been to help them. You know, he's the one who got them the totem, effectively. He seemed to be there.
Yep.
My interpretation is that he was, if he wasn't killed, then something happened to him in that riot where he became something else. And he comes to try and prevent, ultimately help them expose Wharton for who he is, to expose the true evil that's really behind this, which isn't, you know, and the ultimate message, obviously, in the classic X-Files tradition, in classic, you know, Chris Carter tradition, is that the villain, the enemy is not the... You know, the foreign refugee, the you know, the unknown mystical black man. It is the white man, the power hungry white man who has been corrupted, and that's the ultimate message of it.
Let me put this one last thought across about Chester, and leave you with this thought about him.
Go on then.
If we're gonna go to the supernatural, I'd be more comfortable with saying that he is Beauvais' familiar or a homunculus.
Oh, I like that.
That if he's a shape changer and he is that cat, that's what leads me to think if he is in a sense working for Beauvais, he says he's gathering the frogs, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he does, yeah. From the grave.
For him. So whether or not he was ever a real boy, it's hard to say, or whether he becomes the familiar or the homunculus, he's created as that in the image of the boy that dies, is hard to say. But that's where I'm going to fall when it comes down to supernatural. I'd almost be more interested in that than in a ghost, because it just, to me, in these loose sort of rules about ghosts, it just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't fully add up.
I think being Beauvais familiar would work far better.
I really like that, and I think it's because all through growing up and when I first watched this and I've rewatched it, I've always assumed that Chester was a ghost. But in analysing it and looking deeper and talking about it, it makes much more sense that yeah, he's some kind of, you know, something linked to Beauvais, something a little bit different. And I think that's a great theory. I really do, and it leaves it open. Finally, I just really want to go back as we get towards the ending, which is obviously, you know, Wharton being exposed as the person who's been killing these military men in order to try and aid his agenda of getting rid of the refugees and pinning it on Beauvais. I want to go back to something that X says. You know, we mentioned Mr. X earlier, who gives Mulder some of that key information that is always helpful. He says a brilliant line where he says the Statue of Liberty is on vacation. And that really leapt out at me as a fascinating line, especially in the current political climate, really. This idea that our morals as a race of people, you know, and one of the great things, and one of the things I think people around the world love about the American spirit, is that there is a real sense of principle in the way the American, you know, the Americans live their lives, and the way the whole, you know, the whole country was built, effectively. And I think it's fascinating that, you know, X is basically suggesting that given the government a complicit in what is considered Wharton's revenge for these men dying, you know, in these riots and things like that, these accidental deaths, is really a terrifying thought, actually. And it's a scary line to say, the Statue of Liberty is on vacation. As an American, what do you think about that, Jim?
I think when he says that, my first thought was that he was referring to something that maybe I had forgotten as far as in the setup of the show, or that was going on at that time in the real world. It's a tough one, and I'm not alone in this, and I'm sure that in the UK that people are feeling this also. I'm living in a divided country.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it's a tough one. I feel in the middle of it all. I can't totally agree with that line as far as relating it to, you know, to now or to then, for that matter. As a writer, it's a very strong line, and I compliment them for its inclusion. To throw it out, you would seem to want to have some debate on it. Yeah. Of course, again, we don't have time. It's an interesting scene. It's like you said, it's a very, very brief scene, which is why I kind of asked, like, did it have to be X?
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or,
it's a good,
you know,
question.
Do you want more of X when you, or is X better when you see so little of him? Yeah, it's a tough one. It's a good line, but I think that you really want to have the opportunity to sort of dissect it and to debate it.
Yeah.
I try to stay out of such discussions as much as possible.
Probably wise.
I have friends on both sides and all sides of the political spectrum, and it's a tough one. But it's just another example of this episode having things that still ripple through the pond,
yeah,
to this day, to this very day.
And it's surprising when you look back and see that in an episode that not everyone remembers as one of the classic X-Files, but I think has a lot of merit, you know. And then it obviously builds to the conclusion in the one of the creepiest graveyards I think the show ever did, with the rolling mist and the candles.
Oh yeah, that is. I'm glad you said that, because I would have even forgotten to say something about that. Absolutely, it is a very, very effective. Everything looked good. I'll give it that. I'll give it the episode that everything looked very, very good here. The cinematography, sets, everything. And like I said, I complimented the practical effects of Scully's assault on Scully in the car.
It was amazing.
And less is more. When you see the fingers coming up out of her cut, any more than what we saw would have potentially made it look fake.
Yeah.
But you see just enough, and then suddenly you have a full human, seemingly human being right there. And on her.
Just talking about that hand, the sequence where the man emerges from Scully's hand, it was a male actor who pushed his gelatine-covered fingers through another mechanical hand. That's how they did that effect, which I think is really clever.
Was that supposed to be Beauvais?
I don't know, because Beauvais was confronting Wharton. So I don't know if it was supposed to be Beauvais in two places at once, or it was supposed to be just a random Haitian priest or something like that. Yeah, I wondered that myself.
Wouldn't it have been even more creepy? It would have been creepier if it was supposed to be Beauvais, and that was simply a shade that he had produced somehow. It goes quick, it's dark, obviously. You can't really tell if I don't think it's the same actor. I'm not sure if anybody is aware of that or not. But I like to think that he projected. If we're going to go down the supernatural road, that he projected his image to do that. But again, it's fascinating that it goes away immediately when she grabs the charm the totem.
Yeah, no, it is. I love that. I love the suggestion of it, and I think that's brilliant. It's also interesting what Wharton says as well, because he speaks in with this really sort of demonic guttural tone.
Oh yeah, that is very effective.
Yeah, it's really good. I'd forgotten he did that. He speaks an incantation in Creole, which is obviously the Haitian dialect of French, because there's no subtitles, so nobody quite knows what he says. But it's translated roughly as "to the saints, to the moon, to the stars." Which is fascinating. And interestingly enough, speaking of voodoo, this symbol that we see painted on the tree and under the car and on the conch shell is called a veve, which is a sign that belongs to the spirits honoured in voodoo. But none of these things are specifically mentioned, and I like that. It just drops in some of this lore, and it doesn't necessarily need to explain it all to you. It leaves it open for you to maybe go and look into and things like that.
If you look at the Wikipedia page for Fresh Bones, it describes what Wharton does to Mulder in the cemetery as sympathetic magic. And that's interesting in itself, because it doesn't say seemingly sympathetic magic. It just says that's what he does to Mulder. It's another interesting scene, because if you're coming at it from Scully's point of view, how does he do what he does to Mulder? He drops him in tracks. What is it? Is it again? Is there something in the air? Is it the candles are giving off a chemical? Is there something else that Wharton does at that moment and it causes that reaction in Mulder? I do like that moment. I think it's very interesting. And again, that the voice is very effective.
Yeah.
The setting is effective, the voice, and then what actually happens is all good.
Yeah, it is, and it's got a great ending. It is a bit histrionic, I suppose, to an extent, but it's scary. It leaves you with loads of questions, and then finally Wharton's in the grave, buried alive, as you mentioned earlier. A terrifying thing. Again, that was one thing that always stuck with me. Wharton screaming, buried alive, certain to die. And it's one of those amazing stinger endings that The X-Files is really good at, either leaving you with Mulder and Scully in shock, or a horrible thing that's happening to somebody, or a revelation that something terrifying still exists. And I love it when the show does that.
I'll go on record as saying that this is as an effective of a final scene as a pair of eyes opening up in the darkness underneath a bed.
Yeah, definitely.
If you know where I'm going with that.
Yes. No, I completely agree. It's terrifying.
Scully gets the cut on her hand from the thorns, and they get in the car, and Mulder says, "Here, let me take a look at that." And he tries to take her hand, and she, of course, just shuts him down. There's an awkward moment there.
I need to go back and look at that. I didn't clock that. I didn't spot it.
I think you do. And I'm open to it. Let's let your listeners decide if this qualifies. but to me, there's far more there. Mulder much liked to take her hand. She almost realizes what that would be like and just says, "I'm fine. It's fine." And there's an awkward sort of silence moment there. I think you have to watch Mulder. That's where it jumped right out at me, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm imagining things, but I'm going to challenge everybody to go back and look at that moment and tell me Tell me that it's not a so-called shipping moment.
Well, that's really interesting, and it could be off the back of, it could be a subtle thing that they put in there off the back of you know, obviously Scully's trauma at the abduction she experienced earlier in the season, but also Irresistible, which we talked about recently, which is where she basically struggles with being able to cope at work, and she has to go and see a counselor, you know, and she asks, you know, do you trust your partner? Are you happy with your partner? It's one of the questions she asks. So, you know, and it's fascinating that maybe because of what's happened to her, there is an element of, at this stage, an element of familiarity and trust and closeness that Scully can't quite handle.
It's more than just the physical action or reaction. There's a strange vibe. It's there and then it goes away quickly. But it's to me, I saw the immediate disappointment in Mulder for being shut down. And maybe it is that he just cares and he wants to see if his partner's okay. But I took it as a little bit more. It's just a very quick and subtle nod to the affection there.
Very, very interesting. Well, I'll encourage anyone to go back. Let us know what you think about that one, because that's an interesting thing after you listen to this, guys.
Here's the passenger manifest you asked for.
Thank you.
They're petitioning to have Beauvais return to Haiti.
Too bad it has to be in a box.
Is this a complete list?
As far as I know.
There was a boy. His name was Bonaparte. Chester Bonaparte?
Sure, Chester. Poor kid. He died 6 weeks ago in that riot.
All returnees.
So that brings us to the end of going in depth on Fresh Bones. But before we go, we're not going to do the X quiz this time. I'm sparing Jim the misery of the X quiz. You've suffered enough.
Boy.
You've had enough questions today.
The five questions were hard enough, man.
But so instead, we're going to talk about you. And we're going to talk about your contribution, to, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, to the latest IDW publishing anthology for The X-Files, edited by Jonathan Mayberry. And it's 15 stories, all short stories, anthology stories, if you didn't know, about Mulder and Scully's investigations on The X-Files. And they're all really varied from different time points throughout the series, and they all have very different vibes. Now, I reviewed yours, Jim, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And you did a great little blog interview with us.
That has to be one of the nicest reviews I've ever had. I really appreciate it. I thought, wow, okay, maybe I'm a good writer. I don't know.
Oh, yes, definitely. No, okay. It was really, really good. Honestly, it was great. It was a great story. So do you want to just, for anyone who maybe is thinking of buying Secret Agendas or who hasn't, do you want to tell us a little bit about the story and just a little bit about what inspired you to write it?
Sure. It's a Mulder-centric story. I didn't set out necessarily to do that. It became that as I started plotting it. And it also went off the rails somewhat from what I originally thought that I was doing, but that's really one of those, to me, magical moments in a writer's life and career when characters and situations sort of take on a life of their own and they tell you what they want to do. And it was most definitely, you know, that case. I knew that I wanted to write what we call a Monster of the Week type episode, and that's pretty much what I did. I know it's funny. It's like, to go into it a little bit more, there are some surprises along the way, and I don't want to ruin it. Suffice to say, Mulder and Scully are returning to DC from a previous investigation, and we get a little tiny hint about what that is, but they're in separate cars. And they're traveling through Virginia, and a breakdown. And by that I mean a car breakdown. Not the other. He gets to that other point, but and he does actually quickly call that out as a cliche. Traveling at night and car breakdown on the lonely road out in the middle of nowhere kind of a thing. Like, how could that not go wrong? And he makes his way into a little town, and things sort of escalate from there. He very quickly meets a woman who has an effect on him that maybe no other woman has really had that kind of effect on him before.
Definitely.
And he begins to think that he may be on the trail of one of the more interesting cryptozoological entities out there. And suffice to say, it becomes much, much more than that.
It's a great little story because, I said in my review, I really feel like he's tested by the end of this, that he goes through something that really does test his strength of character. And I think it's a great little story, and it throws him really down the rabbit hole, throws him out of his comfort zone, actually, Mulder. And especially when it comes to how he relates with to women as well, which is always a fascinating thing when it happens in the show. Women who aren't Scully, anyway.
Exactly. One of the things that I love is in Home. I believe it's in Home that he actually says that he likes small towns.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he surprises everyone by saying that he wouldn't mind settling down in a small
town.
It's true.
And I really wanted to play on that. He seems to be a creature of the urban jungle, but I really thought that was an interesting angle in this, that he's not exactly a fish out of water, or he doesn't feel that he is. He has to bide his time for some car repairs. Yes, it's another cliche. I get that. But it's a springboard to put him into a situation where hopefully something very interesting is going to come out of.
You must have been really excited at the chance to write an X-Files story for this, really, as a fan.
Oh, yeah. And I sort of stumbled into it. Jonathan Avery, who I've followed for a while now and so admire as a writer and as one of the really prominent horror writers of our time. And I had literally just joined the Horror Writers Association Facebook page. I think it was literally the day before he posts on there that he's working, putting the author list together for the third volume of IDW's X-Files anthologies, and that he had some slots to fill, and that he was throwing open the door for pitches. And I don't know if this does not happen very often. Here's a professional writer, editor, basically going to the public and saying, okay, we'll take pitches for this licensed work, and not just any licensed work, but the X-Files. So I stopped everything that I was doing and and I started in on a plot and sent it to him, and I felt pretty good about it, but I thought, wow, he's going to get a lot of pitches. And maybe mine will just get lost in it, or he's going to go with names that he recognizes. I, for the most part, I believe that Jonathan might have been aware of me at that time. We had a little bit of discourse back and forth, but before that, but a week later, he was posting about how he was working through the pitches. He was reading all the pitches and he's like, I don't know how I'm going to get through all of these. And I posted something like coffee, like lots and lots of coffee as a comment to him.
Yeah.
The next thing I know, I see that I have a private message waiting for me on Facebook, open it up, and it's Jonathan. And he says, awesome. really liked your story idea. Can you deliver I think it was 7,000 word story by whatever date? Might have been like December 31st, and this was late November, something like that. So basically a month. And I'm like, yeah. Like, well, stupid me. Like what are you getting at? Like, it was just an odd opening to the whole thing. Like, you know, sure. Like, even if he said it was, can you deliver it within 24 hours? Of course I'm going to say yes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I think I literally type, yeah, yes, ? Boom, send that. He comes back. Okay, welcome to the X-Files.
Awesome.
found out that he supposedly had gotten 680 pitches.
Wow.
I know. Yeah.
That's amazing.
So I felt incredibly honored and humbled and all of that. And then, of course, there's that horrible realization that, okay, now you have to actually write it. One of the worst feelings that you can get, you got that elation and then you get the deflation.
Oh crap,
I have to write this now. I went and watched a few episodes. I hadn't watched an episode in a little while, but I watched some episodes. I really wanted to get the cadence of the characters' speech patterns in my mind firmly there. I really need to hear the characters talking as I'm writing, and then went from there. It came out of me fairly quickly, the actual writing, and I felt pretty good about it. Had a couple of my friends who are big X-Files fans read it and to tell me whether they felt it was true to the characters, and I got some good responses, and now here we are. So right now it's my very first mainstream licensed work, and I'm really, really proud of it.
Oh, what a way to begin then. I mean, that's a hell of a thing to have, something connected to the X-Files. So yeah, congratulations, Jim, because it's a great story.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's a great little anthology. These anthologies are so good. I hope they carry on for so long, because it's a great thing that Jonathan's doing, putting all this together.
I really hope they continue, because I've got another X-Files story. I'm crossing my fingers that this wasn't my only chance, because I have my own Jose Chung's from Outer Space that really needs to get out of my head.
Yes.
I have my own story in that vein, and I've got it all plotted out. Yeah, it's like and I have to make it up to the Scully fans that it's funny. I was saying earlier, I'm a Scully fan, and here I go to a Mulder centric. But I think it was appropriate that, and I love that phrase of putting him down the rabbit hole. That's a great phrase, and it was just somehow felt right and more appropriate that he be put through that because of his very particular interests.
Yeah,
that it's him. Scully does play her part in this story, but it's really Mulder that had to be put through this, in my opinion.
And put through it very well, yeah. So it's great. You can read Desperately Seeking Mothman, which is still an amazing title as well, I have to say.
And hey, you know what? And that was always the title that hit me. I sent it in with that title, sent the pitch in with that title. Brilliant. It's one of those wonderful moments where that just appeared full cloth in my head, and it was never any other title but that.
Oh, it's great, and it's obviously part of the as I say, the Secret Agendas anthology, which is available through IDW Publishing, and you can buy that right now, so get on it, guys, if you haven't already, because it's great. It just leaves me to thank you, Jim, really, for coming on and being part of the X-Cast. It's been brilliant to have you on the show, and hopefully it won't be for the last time.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this, and I'm really enjoying interactions with the X-Files fandom. It's just another great body of fans and who are so passionate and really love this interest, and I just love being part of these things. So thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Oh no, it's my pleasure. It absolutely is. Where can people find you then on social media if they want to find more of what you're doing?
Yeah, hopefully they'll check out my Amazon author page. You can literally just go to Amazon and put in my name, Jim Beard, and my author page should come up. I'm not the musician, by the way, Jim Beard. I'm the writer.
Yeah, make that distinction, guys.
Yeah.
Important distinction.
On Facebook, you can find my page by putting in The Beard, the Jim Beard fan page. I hate saying fan page, but I can always use a few more likes over there and hopefully some interaction. And I'm on Twitter, although I haven't fully figured out exactly what are the best ways to use Twitter. And my handle is @writerJimBeard, all one word, @writerJimBeard. And
go look at Jim's stuff, look at his page, look at his Twitter, because there's lots more great writing there, so you guys can enjoy that. And if you want to find us on the social media, we're at @X_cast on Twitter, if you haven't found us already. We're at Facebook. We've got a Facebook page. Just type in the X-Cast. We've got a Facebook group, obviously, the Facebook, the X-Cast X-Files podcast fan group, which you can join up. Jim's part of that group, and
yes,
a bunch of other people. So it's a great little community that's building up on there on Facebook. And we're on iTunes. If you just type in the X-Cast on iTunes, leave us a like, and again, a review. You know, talking about reviews on Amazon, on iTunes, it's helpful as well. So that will get us even more known amongst the fandom, and we can just keep building this podcast as we go through the many, many years to come before we reach season 10.
And if Gillian Anderson is listening, she really needs to go on to Tony's show.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Jill, you're bound to be listening. Just let's do it. Let's make this happen. Come on. You can bring David if you want as well, it's fine. for a bit of company. But yeah, one last thanks, Jim. It's been great to have you on. We'll definitely see you again on the show, hopefully.
Thank you. We'd love to.
And we'll be back very soon, guys, for a brand new episode covering something amongst the X-Files. But until then, always remember, trust no one. The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter @IAmWillAYE.